proverbial one more year syndrome, because the pay at work is great. It's very, very generous. So I'm happy about that. But it has kept me locked down to my seat in the office, so to speak. And that's just not working for me anymore.
Welcome, millionaires and future millionaires. You're listening to the Millionaires Unveiled podcast, the show where you'll hear the stories and interviews of everyday millionaires. We'll unveil their decisions, their strategies, and their portfolio allocation. Now to your host, Jace Mattinson.
Welcome back to another episode of the Millionaires Unveiled podcast. This is episode number 351. Stace, happy Easter to you.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yeah, you're back and at it.
I am hanging in there.
Don't fool me. You're crushing it. So yeah, I hope everybody had a great Easter. We sure did. It was kind of fun. The kids are at a fun age for that. And of course, we had two little new ones to join the group. Last week, we released episode number 350 and generated quite the buzz. In fact, we got all sorts of reviews. Yeah, and I kind of wanted to address a few of them. Because I want to, I guess, bring a little bit of clarity to one of these. But one of them, this came from Avid Listener 33, though, and this was before last week's episode. And basically said that we disregarded some listener concerns and lack of vision here. I'm not quite sure what that means. But anyway, I'd appreciate an email if you'd send an email to me. And we can get some things cleared up. We obviously take feedback from our listeners very seriously. So I'd love to understand what that means. As always, for anybody, if you got any suggestions, send us an email, millionairesunveiled@gmail.com. Also, if you want to be on the show, send us an email, millionairesunveiled@gmail.com. So this one comes from BLU321. He says, better questions, please. So love the guests and the concept, which is why I keep listening, but please ask better questions and follow-up questions. You've got a guy you've never heard of, we've never heard of, claiming to have a net worth of $350 million, but barely skimmed the surface of his story. It seems like the host just going through a list of questions he wrote down without even listening to the guest answers. He just says, that's interesting, then moves on to the next question. Didn't even ask what the guy's accent was after he teased it for 5 straight minutes. Study Tim Ferriss and other good interviewers, hoping it improves. Appreciate it. Try to ask some better questions. If you got any suggestions on better questions, send them to me. Love to look at that. Also, in regards to the accident, yeah, I didn't ask him on purpose. That's just not public information and didn't really need to be shared with the group. I know he mentioned it and brought it up and that was kind of a turning point, but that wasn't something that we were going to get into and disclose to the world on what that was for him. So sorry about that. But there is a lot to his story, but it's also, 45-minute interview. So we tried to pack in as much as possible. And I made it in the payments industry. So anyway, if you got any other comments, be loose, send them over my way. This one comes from Sally. Congratulations on your new bundles of joy. Keep up the great interviews. I learn something new each week. James says, it's interesting that someone worth that much made their money in credit. It's really inspiring to see that he's turning to help others. Good for him. Great interview. Also got one from Emmanuel. Appreciate this one. He said, don't worry about the haters. Keep doing what you do best. Podcast. Appreciate that, Emmanuel. No, I love all the hate mail. Helps us get better.
That makes one of us. No, but really, we do appreciate your feedback and hope to improve. I am always learning and I'm always handwriting out my questions throughout the interview so I don't forget them. So there's definitely not a list of questions to ask except for our rapid fire at the end. We have kind of some that we pull from there, but we definitely don't have just a list of questions out. That'd be nice. I would like that. I'd like a list of questions.
That's how it started in the early days, but I haven't probably referred to a list of questions for, I don't know, probably almost 5 years at this point. I've done it enough and we've kind of got the format, but I'm always up for better questions. Recently, I guess in the last 6 months, kind of rearranged or added and changed some things on the rapid fire. And I know some people want some of the old ones back, but yeah, always looking for questions that will inspire. I mean, to be mentioned, I guess, with Tim Ferriss, pretty amazing. Maybe I should study him a little more. He is probably one of the best out there, him and Joe Rogan. And yeah, I wish I had their production crew too. That'd be pretty amazing. And heck, they got a whole team. Man, if I could get the deal they have, like, and have $10 million plus dollar budget per year, that would be pretty fun too. But at any rate, We always appreciate you leaving reviews, even if they aren't five stars.
I was not on last week's interview. I've missed some of these over the last little bit, given our growing family, our family that grew. It's not growing anymore. It's done. We're done. But we do have someone really close to us who had a bad accident, and it's a really sensitive topic. And so, although I was not in this interview, I would not be surprised for Jace to have not pried on what the accident was, because sometimes they can be traumatic experiences. So anyway, maybe just a note, can be a sensitive topic, just to actually dive into something that might have been a major turning point in someone's life.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that. And that wasn't necessarily a reason, but that is, that does provide some extra context. But I am going to mention, since you brought it up, there was my sister who had a crazy accident and has gone through an amazing transformation, you know, nearly dead to where she is today. And she is kicking butt, just set a national record in the 100 meter dash and is training for the Paralympics. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we are headed to France at the end of the summer to watch her run. And that would be pretty sweet. But yeah, she is, she's quite the Wonder Woman. That's for sure. And yeah, today's guest, pretty interesting, lives in Canada. His name is Dividend Daddy. He loves his dividends. In fact, we get into a pretty deep discussion on dividends versus index funds and why he prefers dividends, even though he thinks that probably, and is admitting to it on the podcast, that index funds typically are better. But yeah, he's in Canada. He's got some real estate as well. And we have a really interesting discussion too about kind of that one more year syndrome of working for one more year versus retiring. But as you'll see in the episode and everything else with him, that he's ready. He's ready for a change. And I know a lot of people have asked too to mention their age, and he is in his early 40s or early to mid 40s. So hopefully that gives you some context around the interview. And not married and doesn't have kids. And he also mentions that on the podcast too. But since he did, I'll note that for those listeners as well. Let's get into today's episode with Dividend Daddy. Dividend Daddy, will you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're up to now?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on your podcast. Long-time listener, first-time caller, so appreciate that. A little bit about myself. I'm mid-40s. I'm Canadian, so there's that. Investor in stock market equities and real estate. I'm a bit of a dividend fiend, so maybe that sets me a little bit apart. I do the ETFs and index funds, but also dividend investor. And looking to transition in life away from full-time employment to contract employment that might free up more time for me to spend my life in other places in this world.
Interesting. We got a lot there. I want to get into all of it. Before we do, what's your net worth today?
It's in the couple million, so multi-million for sure. And that's split, as I mentioned previously, between real estate and equities.
And is the real estate that you have, is that single family, multifamily, syndication type investments? What is the real estate makeup?
It's made up of my principal home. It's mortgage free currently. And then I've got another investment property in the Canadian city I live in, as well as a vacation property down south that I rent out or have under property management.
And does that have a mortgage on it?
Yeah, both the rental property and the vacation property currently have mortgages on them.
So you've got a paid for primary, but mortgages on the investment properties. Walk us through, how did that kind of come about, and why did you pay off your primary early?
Yeah, a couple things. It's a bit of, you could sleep at night better with the mortgage paid off. There's also some fundamental differences between Canada and the US. You can't get these mortgages locked in for long periods of time. Don't correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the US, you can go like 30 years locked in. And a lot of people did that when the interest rates were really low recently. Canada, you can only lock in for 5 years and then you have to renew. 5 years is as long as you can do it. So, you know, when you come up to renew, your mortgage interest rate is either going to be higher. Of course, depends if you go variable or fixed, but it's going to be either higher or lower, but you only got 5 years. So you're constantly renewing a mortgage. You can go lock it in for periods of less than 5 years, but you can't do more than 5 years. So that inspires, I think, some Canadians, maybe more than Americans, I don't know, to pay off a mortgage sooner if they're in that financial position to do so. I was, so I opted to pay it off. And I have no regrets, really. You know, that money I was putting towards the mortgage, principal mortgage every year. It's also the interest on our principal mortgages in Canada, unlike the US, are not, you can't deduct the interest. So that's another difference. So that might encourage Canadians to pay off mortgages sooner. Anywho, I'm very happy I did. That money I was paying towards the mortgage I used and turned around and started investing even more money into the stock market with that surplus cash. The rental property cash flows currently, all expenses in it cash flows. And then the vacation property just started renting out this fall. So I don't really have full data for a year, but it's renting well so far. And I'm pleased with that. And I'll actually be going down later this month to spend some time there myself.
Interesting. So I didn't know that you can only lock in for 5 years there. I guess my question on that is, like, how does that play into, I mean, people's budgets, you know, like with an interest rate environment like it is now, where if they would be coming up for renewal, all of a sudden they possibly couldn't afford their house that they were in. Does that happen?
Yes. It's particularly in this most recent interest rate environment with rapid increases. I'm in an unfortunate position, so I recognize that position I'm in. But for a lot of Canadians in particular, the prices, and I bought my homes and my property in Canada. I actually had another rental in Toronto that I sold a couple years ago. But I bought all of this property before the recent run-up in Canadian real estate prices. You know, they've gone absolutely through the roof. To afford a home in a Canadian city, you're spending, you know, if not $1 million, close to it, and a lot of the cases over that. And so you've got a lot of people that were stretched to be able to afford the mortgage they have, but then when interest rates shot up, if they weren't fixed, they rushed to lock in a fixed rate. And if they were variable, a lot of them are being crushed, and they run into situations where the amount of mortgage and interest they're paying, sometimes it's not actually paying down the mortgage principal. It's just interest consumption on that. And then when they go to renew, I have a personal friend right now whose mortgage renews in December of 2024. So next year, the end of next year, he's looking to sell because he doesn't want to renew that mortgage that, you know, although the talk lately is interest rates will come down next year, that's not a guarantee, but doesn't want to lock in definitely at higher rates because his mortgage was locked in at much, much lower interest rates of just a few years ago. So this is a struggle for a lot of Canadians, that five-year window. Luckily and fortunate for myself, it's not an issue.
Interesting. So how fast did you pay off that primary then? From the time you bought it?
Yeah, I bought it in, I had another place I sold and sort of moved up to I'm not in a McMansion by any stretch. I'm in a townhouse, but I had a property. My first property I bought in, you know, about 2007, 2008, a small condo, doubled that value of that and sold it. Then I bought a place in 2010 where I am currently, and I paid it off in about 10 years, give or take.
Okay. And during that time, were you also still investing aggressively in the market and other investments?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I was doing both at the same time and saving what money I could. And, you know, I've been fortunate that my income in my employment, my day job has increased steadily over the years. So I was able to invest even more throughout these those past 10 years for sure.
Awesome. So the money that you've been investing in the market, how is that kind of divided? I mean, Canada, you still have like retirement options, correct? Or kind of walk us through where that money's invested.
Yeah. So it's in Canada, we have a registered retirement savings plans, RRSP. We have the tax-free savings account, and then you just have your regular taxable accounts. So after you've exhausted those, the limits on those accounts in terms of contributions each year, then you've got the sort of taxable investment account that you can throw as much money at it that you desire. And there's also some educational accounts for if you have children. I don't have children, so I don't invest in those vehicles. So basically, it's those three vehicles for me. And the RSP is sort of like tax sheltered. You get a discount. You can apply against your income, but later you have to make mandatory withdrawals, I think at 71, and you have to pay tax on it. Then the tax-free savings account, you know, you invest the money in, it's any income earned in those accounts are tax-free. You can withdraw and you're not penalized at that point. So I invest in those vehicles and I max them out every year, the RRSP and tax-free savings account. And the other one, then the surplus goes into the taxable account.
Do you plan, I mean, you mentioned that you're probably going to start transitioning into more contract type employment, but do you still plan to continue to invest in those accounts? Or do you feel like you've reached critical mass at this point for what you want to do in your life that you won't really add much more?
That's a good question. Yes. I've done a lot of thinking about this, and that's the reason I listen to a lot of podcasts like Millionaires Unveiled and a number of other ones, is for that perspective, I guess, on the future and what that could be. Like I say, I'm mid-40s. I can see 50 approaching in the window, and I don't know if it was COVID or otherwise, but some reflection on where I want to go in life. My dividend income, I'm sort of like a hybrid investor. So I started off, when I started investing in the stock market, give or take somewhere in the range of 20 to 25 years ago, you know, with the small amount of income I had at that time, I was strictly an index investor. I read this book called The Wealthy Barber. It's a Canadian book. It's sort of like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the equivalent, but for Canadians. Everything that you have in America, we have in Canada, is just slightly different. And so I read that book as maybe a late teenager, and it really encouraged, you know, putting away what you could afford to do, the sort of 10% growth from their sort of perspective. And years I'm at, you know, 50, 60, 70% savings in terms of what I'm saving from my employment income. But that's grown over time. And right now, so I started off with index investing, ETFs strictly. And then over time, oddly enough, maybe for some, I've transitioned away from index funds to sort of a hybrid state where I'm indexed for international exposure. So my biggest or largest holding is VTI for my US exposure. And then I've got some international index funds as well that are ex-Canada. So they don't include Canada. But within Canada, I am sort of what they call like a moat investor. And what I mean by that, you think about a castle with a moat around it that makes it hard to attack. So I invest in the Canadian banks. They're some of the, if not the safest, some of the safest banks in the world. If a Canadian bank goes down in Canada, there are bigger concerns we have. You know, that's just not going to happen. So I invest heavily in the big banks, the telecoms, the railways, anything, the gas pipelines, anything in Canada where, you know, if you wanted to build a pipeline in Canada, good luck nowadays. If you wanted to build a railway, another one, good luck. If you wanted to charter a bank, good luck. If you wanted to broadband spectrum for telecom, good luck. So these industries are often very expensive for consumers. Our cell phone bills and banking fees are astronomical compared to the rest of the world. So it's awful as a consumer, but it's great if you're an investor because you make very healthy incomes off of these. And these banks, as one example, have been paying dividends in Canada for literally since the 1800s steadily. So I started to transition, I would say, again, give or take 10 years ago-ish, could be a little bit less, towards within Canada, investing in those stable sort of blue chip dividend payers. And right now, my dividend income is about $80,000. My PADI, projected annual dividend income, is about $80,000 each year. So my plan going forward is to live off of that dividend income, plus any contract work I pick up. I'm not looking to pick up a ton of it in 2024, but a little bit to sort of keep my mind and brain fresh and keep me engaged, but really reduce the amount of work I do. I have a desire for location independency, so I don't have to be in the cold north all the time. I can be other places of the world that are sunnier and warmer than what we get up here, and live off the dividends and a bit of contract work. And so that's sort of the plan and why I transitioned to hybrid, so that I really avoid this sequence of return risk. And all the things that I hear, you know, the psychological factors of folks that are following the 4% rule and selling, having to sell in a down market and the psychological toll that takes on them from a sequence of return risk perspective, I recognize as an investor that total returns is far superior from an investment point of view. But at the end of the day, personal finance is personal. I like to sleep well at night, and some dividend income helps me do that. So that's why I've transitioned later in life from index funds strictly 100% to a hybrid state of dividend and index investing.
Interesting. So as you've made this transition, I guess just psychologically, I mean, was there a moment in time that helped you to kind of do that? Was it the outlook of what you wanted your future to look like that was different than where you were? Or kind of, I guess I'm real curious if, you know, there was one event that caused that, or a book or something.
Yeah, I wouldn't say one event, probably a culmination of various things. I discovered FIRE, Financial Independence Retire Early. I would say, I don't quote me on it again, it's been 3-4 years, somewhere in that range. And so the time prior to that, I was investing in real estate and the stock market. Over time, I'm sort of moving away from real estate. I think I'm going to sell my last rental property here in Canada. And I just like dividends. You know, they're easy. You know, they don't call me on the phone to complain about a broken toilet, although I've never gotten that phone call. But I've gotten other phone calls and finding, I manage the one in Canada, the rental property myself, and just finding tenants. And the landlord-tenant tribunal system in Canada, in many provinces, although not all, is very heavily skewed towards the renter. You know, just don't pay rent, don't leave, and that's A-okay. You may get a hearing before the tribunal to get an eviction, maybe in a year, maybe two if you're lucky. Meanwhile, they don't pay. And there's just, it's never happened to me, but there's enough of that. And I'm just sort of thinking, you know, I sit on, you know, on the Saturday morning, I'm reading the paper or whatever I'm doing, and the dividends just come, and it's just easier. So I'm probably moving away from real estate, but I was early on real estate and index investing, and sort of planning for the traditional 60, 65 years of age retirement, not knowing that there was any alternative, frankly. And I was saving a lot compared to the average person, not knowing why, just thinking, well, this is what you do for your standard retirement age. Then I kept reading or seeing online these articles, you know, a little bit annoying ones where they're like, hey, you know, I'm exaggerating here. I'm 20 and I retired early. I'm never going to work again. I kept reading these and I'm like, God, who are all these people that are like 15 years of age and retired? And why am I, you know, in my 30s, late 30s and 40s, still working very hard? I thought, I'd just seen enough of these articles online that were frankly a little bit annoying that I thought, you know what, I'm going to do a little bit of digging. And it was probably the millennial revolution. I'm not a millennial, I'm a tail end Gen Xer, but that website, Christy Bryce, I think, or Bryce and Christy, I think are their names. They're actually Canadian. And I dug a little deeper in one of their articles. I saw them highlighted in an article, early retired. I think they retired sometime in their 30s. And they were Canadians. So I thought, okay, I'm going to dig into this a little bit more. And the concept of FIRE came up. And then I, like everybody here on the show, you go deep. I went down a deep rabbit hole and, you know, surfaced a year later and was like, oh, okay, so there is something different. And then I thought to myself, well, I guess this is what I was doing all along and not knowing that I was in fact doing it. Then of course you start checking your numbers and you realize, oh wow, okay, I'm probably financially independent already and just didn't know it. And so here I am, and fast forward a couple of years and you know, I follow, you know, way more podcasts than I probably should. I've been to, there's not a lot of stuff in Canada in terms of conferences. So I went down to the Economy Conference last year. Just a lot more stuff in the US about FIRE than there is in Canada, although there's some documentaries recently. And yeah, just got involved in that space and decided, well, look, there's an alternative to the standard retirement age that's quite exciting to me, because what I value ultimately is the freedom. If I want to continue to work, and I have, great. But if I no longer want to do that, having the option to do something different is really, that flexibility is what I ultimately value to be able to lead the life I want to live sort of that, you know, F you money, if you like. I can do what I want. And it's really freeing. I respect the power of that at the same time, but I also recognize that if my employer is going to ask me to do something I'm not interested in doing, I'm going to make a change and I can do that. So that's where I'm at.
What has been your career? I guess, what is your career up to this point?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer by training, although I don't practice anymore. I gave back my license. I don't plan to practice. That's probably not the technical legal term for what I did, but I rescinded the license. I can always get it back. You know, you go in and you give them, frankly, just it's a shakedown. It's a bit of a racket. You give them money and you can get your license back. And so if I want to, I can do that, but I don't want to practice anymore. Done a bit of the legal stuff and a bit of sort of public policy space for a number of years, and that's where I am currently, and planning on going next year to work optional state. I do plan to hopefully take my current employer on contract basis, and one contract's enough for me. I've got to work out a relationship with another firm where if I take on additional clients that I don't really want to service because it's too much for me, I can effectively, you know, include them with the other firm and just take a cut of the annual billables and let them service the client. And I'll pop in for a Zoom maybe if that's needed, but I don't necessarily have to do the servicing of the client, which can be quite labor intensive, you know, and I'm sort of not interested in doing all of that all the time anymore. So it will be a sort of work optional contract space, and I'm hoping to make that change early in the new year, you know, sometime around April or so.
Interesting. So do you have any fears of making this transition at all?
It's a good question. I was on a Zoom with a couple of folks actually last night discussing that. And I'd be lying if I didn't say I did. I do have, maybe fear is a strong word, concerns, I guess, or I can't think of another word. So we'll go with concerns. Why? I think it's a bit of, you know, people ask me, well, is it the sort of identity that you have developed over decades, frankly, with your employment? And my response to that is no, I don't think so. Because, you know, as I mentioned, I recently gave in my license to practice. So again, like that's a big deal for some people. I've heard doctors have that transition is difficult for them because they've been a doctor for a good chunk of their life and they're held in high esteem, at least you know, for the most part. Same with lawyers a bit. For me, that was an easy thing. That wasn't a big deal for me. The concerns, or I guess the challenges for me, is the sort of, it's equally a concern, but equally exciting, is it's a bit of the unknown. Like what I'm looking forward to, and the exciting part, is being able to travel more, meet new people, romantically or otherwise, potentially see new places, meet people, and maybe that will lead me down a different path, and maybe I'll be doing some work with them, volunteer or otherwise. Those sort of the exciting potential of the unknown to me is enticing. On the flip end, it's the unknown, like, you know, what if, and I've got a lot of redundancies, I think, that I'm happy to outline, but what if I can't get if I keep the rental, the property rental I have here in Canada, what if I can't get a renter and I have to carry that mortgage cost? What if I can't get, right now my property down south is under property management. What happens if I don't get any renters in there? You know, again, none of these scenarios have ever happened, but in theory, they could. What if there's a big expense on one of those properties, unexpected? So those sort of things are concerning, I guess, but I've got redundancies to deal with them. I do plan to sell the Toronto rental property. So that would, even though it cash flows right now, I could use the proceeds to pay off the vacation property. That would eliminate the debt, frankly, that a small amount of debt that I carry in mortgage debt. I could short-term rent my principal home here in Canada. I'm actually prepping it for that purpose, although I don't think I'll do it. But I could do that. It's a redundancy factor. So selling the Toronto rental property, if things really hit the fan, I could unload the vacation property that's already doubled in value. I could short-term rent my place. I plan to take on contract work, Plus, I have the dividends coming in every day almost. So there's redundancies there that address those concerns I have if, you know, hit the fan, so to speak. But those are the sort of things that kind of probably why I find myself in the 2023 doing that proverbial one more year syndrome, because the pay at work is great. It's very, very generous. So I'm happy about that. But it has kept me locked down to my seat in the office, so to speak. And that's just not working for me anymore.
Interesting. So I guess the plans are you're probably not staying put as part of this program that you're trying to put in place for kind of your next phase of life. You plan to go lots of places. Is that correct? And kind of work remotely as necessary?
Yeah, that's correct. That's the plan. You know, I'm a sort of, sometimes it's easier for me if someone pushes me off the cliff, and please don't, but you get the expression. If someone pushes me, it's easier than me jumping sometimes. That's just the way I'm built maybe. So in order to push myself, I book some travel in April. So I'm going to jump on a cruise. I'm going to be in Europe doing some touring, cycle-based touring. I'm a big cyclist. So I'll be doing some of that, plus seeing some friends. For how long in Europe, I haven't decided yet. There's no return flight booked. Obviously, I will come back at some point. Then I'd like to pop into home for a bit. And then when it starts to get cold here, because it gets cold more of the time than less of the time here, we've got technically 3 months of summer here in Canada. It's more likely sometimes two, depending on what you get. And so head down to South America, Argentina and other places, Colombia, Medellin, maybe go to some places that are digital nomad hubs, because I do plan to do some contract work. Again, it won't be a 9-to-5, Monday to Friday sort of deal, but some time and some time to explore, maybe plug myself in, or at least try to plug myself into some of the digital nomad communities internationally. I'm probably a little bit older than most of them, but plug myself into those communities for friendship and social companion purposes. Spend some more time at my property in Mexico, which I would like to do. And that sort of future visioning of that property is, you know, in my 60s, when my desire to travel is, I'm assuming, I don't know yet, the desire to travel may reduce over time with age. I'll spend more time there in the sunny climate of Mexico rather than the cold climate here. And so, yeah, I plan to do travel some more and work remotely on a very small contractual basis. I don't want this to be a full-time Monday to Friday sort of deal.
So you're done with the cold weather, it sounds like.
Yes, I am, frankly. I could be very happy if I don't see a snowflake again in my life. So I am going to try to position my location. I've seen enough snow in my life. I don't need to see any more of it. My parents are snowbirds themselves, so they're out of here for at least 6 months, and they come back so they don't lose access to the healthcare and run into other situations with the Canada Revenue Agency. But that's sort of the plan. And then I've been all over South America, the Caribbean, a lot of places in the U.S., of course, and all over Canada and all over Western and Central Europe. I haven't been to Eastern Europe, so I'll probably dip into Eastern Europe next year. And I want to go to more places in South America, but particularly I'd love, and this is where the sort of, you know, standard 2 weeks or even 4 week vacation for me anyways, I'm not a happy flyer in an airplane, but the standard 2 week or 4 week vacation where you rush to a destination, you get off the plane, you rush to the hotel, you're checking stuff off your list of things you must do and see in these places. Look, we've all done it. We've all been there and it's fine. I've just reached a stage in my life where I don't enjoy that as much, and I'm in a position where I don't have to do that, I don't think, anymore. So the idea is slow travel. So I'd love to get over to Asia. And I've never been. It's a bit of a hike. And so I'd love to be able to go, and 2 weeks, even 4 weeks is not enough for me, given my I just don't like flying. And so if I can get there and spend months there, that can, for me, justify a flight. And then I would plan to maybe break it up. Like I could see myself flying from maybe flying to Vancouver, spending a couple days, flying to Hawaii, never been. spending a couple days flying, then assuming they have flights, I don't know, I've never looked into this, but Hawaii to over to Asia, and then sort of break that up. Again, you need the time freedom to be able to do that. And right now, if I was going to Asia as an employee at my job, I'd have to take vacation time, fly direct, hustle, and fly back. And it's just not in the cards for me anymore. I did a lot of that when I was younger, and still young. I still have the energy and drive to move around and see lots of this world, but I'm going to do it at a much slower pace. So that's something I'm also looking forward to.
Man, this looks exciting. I'm excited for you too. We just barely met, but this sounds awesome. You've got it planned out extremely well, it sounds like. Are you married or have any kids?
Never married, no kids. So again, that makes it a little bit easier for me. For example, people say, you know, wow, you save a lot of money. And I say, yes, you know, not having children, I recognize, makes that easier. I've never owned a car in my life either. So that makes it easier as well to save money, because I'm not spending it on buying a car that depreciates the moment you drive it off the lot. But for COVID, when used car prices went up. But so I saved the money that way, and had not having children or being married and potentially risking divorce, I guess, also saved some money.
Interesting. Well, let's wrap up with some rapid fire questions. What's the most expensive pair of shoes that you purchased?
Probably dress shoes at maybe, and this is in Canadian figures, of course, so adjusted, I would say $300, $400 for some dress shoes. You know, going to a law firm every day, you've got to look that part. Unfortunately, I didn't enjoy it, but I did. So yeah, I'd say a couple hundred bucks on dress shoes.
Okay, what about the most expensive meal out?
I have been partnered before. And so on either it was an anniversary sort of dating situation, you know, dating for whatever anniversary it was, or perhaps it was my partner's birthday, I can't recall. I would say maybe $400 at one of these sort of very exclusive, what do they call those? Tasting menu type restaurants that are very highly rated. It was in Toronto, and we had a lovely meal. The service was exquisite. It was worth it, every penny of it. But that would probably be the most expensive meal for me.
Okay. Do you remember how much it was?
About 400 Canadian, give or take.
Oh, 400 Canadian. Okay. We talked about the car. So that's crazy. You've never owned a car. Has there been any ever desire? Have you gone and driven rental cars or supercars or anything to do that experience, or just, hey, never touched it, never interested?
I have zero interest in sports cars. I don't get the fascination with them. I mean, they're pretty to look at. I can see them. I don't want to drive them. If I bought a car, I'd get an old daddy car, you know, before I got one of those sports cars. But no, I've never owned a car. I've also lived in big cities. I've always lived in urban centers. Either I've lived in the US and I've lived in Canadian. And even when I was going to university, which is what you guys would call college, we would call it university. College is for the trades in Canada. But I've always lived in major urban centers that I could use public transit, walking. And my favorite mode of travel is my bicycle. So when I travel to New York City, I'm on the bike share in New York City. I love bicycling. I bicycle everywhere. The problem is in Canada, it gets cold for a lot of the year, and I'm a fair weather biker. I'm not going to bundle up and brave icy conditions, although a number of people do, and that's great. That's not me. So, but I do bike whenever I can, which is probably 8 months of the year, give or take. I stretch a little bit into the cold weather, and I walk and take public transit. So yeah, no desire to own a car. That might change as I get older and my ability to face the weather and other inconveniences change. But right now, never owned one and don't want to own one. I rent if I need it. And rideshare like Uber has made that a lot easier too.
Yeah, I've wondered a little bit about that, not just necessarily living in, I guess, big urban centers, but even, you know, places that may not have public transport. Because I do have a friend who basically got rid of the car thing and literally essentially takes Ubers everywhere, but he says his productivity, and he's a realtor, so it makes a little more sense that he can like kind of work in the car and go between homes and everything else. But yeah, he ditched the car and said that it significantly saved him quite a bit of money and time to be able to execute. So I've wondered if Uber, you know, over the years would do that for some people. And it sounds like for you, between public transport and that, you know, it's made it so, hey, I don't need to own a car and have that expense in my life.
Yeah, I don't avoid the expense. And like I say, I primarily use public transit, walking, and cycling. And cycling is my first choice. I also am a member of one of these sort of auto share companies where I can get access to cars that are parked at locations near me. And if I will need to rent one, that I'm going further than you would go in an Uber. Maybe I'm visiting a friend at their cottage or whatever I'm doing, and I need a car for like a day or a few days, I have access to that as well. And you pay a small membership. I think it's $40 a year. And then you can rent it again for longer trips or longer duration. So I do avail myself of that as well.
Oh, that's awesome. What's a key lesson that you learned from childhood?
You know, I'm going to say my grandfather, he was not a lawyer or doctor or anything. He was sort of salt of the earth, canic, and so never made a lot of money, but was involved in World War II and all that good stuff. And, you know, I can remember he would say, you know, he'd always had a nice car. He liked cars. I guess a mechanic in him liked cars. And he always kept it, you know, it was immaculate. And I remember grandparents would visit as a kid, and the cars would be really clean and well kept. And he'd tell me, take me out to look at the car. And he, you know, when you buy a car sometimes from a dealership, it's got the dealer's name and one of those like things that they stick on the back of your car. It would annoy me, but I see a lot of cars have the dealership on the back of the car, at least in Canada. I don't know about the US. And he'd say, you don't see one of those on my car because I own the car. I paid cash. So he always paid cash. And so he saved his money. And he didn't have a lot of it by Bunny's rich. I've got significantly way more net worth than he ever had. But, you know, lived in the same spot, and I think partially built the wartime home that he lived in his entire adult life, and saved his money. And so that was an influence, I think, on me in terms of just that role model. It stuck with me. I paid with cash. I own it. The bank doesn't own it. The same went for his house. He owned the house. The bank didn't own it. I never saw him use credit card. He would drive to, now he was a senior at this time. So fast forward, he was a retired senior at this point, but he would drive, and maybe he did this when he was working. I don't know how he did it back then, but he would drive to pay the water bill, the utility bill, with a check or cash, if you like, just not putting anything on credit cards. So that was, I guess, closest to a role model that I can think of.
Awesome. What's the most fun that you've ever had with money?
Most fun I ever had with money, and it wasn't a heck of a lot of money. Again, I'm not a big believer that you need to spend enormous amounts of money to have fun. I would think the one that comes to my mind is when I was in law school. So at least in Canada, after the first year of law school, so you've done the first year, and then there's the summer 4-month break between first and second year. Some people get jobs in law firms. They're very few and far between. So most students wouldn't get law jobs. I had another job lined up that was non-law. And I thought to myself, I was in my early 20s at the time. I thought to myself, I can't afford to backpack financially. I can't afford to backpack at the time around Europe for 4 months, but I can't afford not to do it. And I'm glad I did, because I borrowed some money actually from my student loan, which was interest-free until you graduate. So I borrowed some of that money. It was meant only for school, but what the heck. I probably put some money on credit cards, a little bit of money, and went to Europe for 4 months and backpacked around. And I just remember great things like being in Switzerland in this particular point in the trip and bicycling, you know, at missing the train. The last train at whenever that was, 2 a.m., I was out to that time then, not anymore. And bicycling back for a couple hours home through vineyards and wherever the friend I was with knew the way to go. And those experiences, again, absolutely free, a little bit of money I borrowed to do it. But those 4 months in Europe, you never get that opportunity. I still physically fit. I could do that backpacking trip again now in my 40s. But I have no desire to be in hostels, being woken up at 2 a.m. by partiers and all that stuff that goes along with that lifestyle. I'm glad I did it then. And that's probably some of the most fun I've had with money, albeit a little bit of money.
Awesome. What has been the craziest thing that you've ever done to earn money?
Yeah, I listened to your podcast enough to think about this question because I knew it was coming up. Nothing really. I've been fortunate that I've had pretty actually decent jobs. Now I've worked hard and networked and did all the stuff you needed to do, get good grades to get yourself lined up to get a good job. The only thing that comes to mind, and it's not crazy at all, I sold a hockey card when I was a kid. You know, I used to collect hockey cards, you know, hockey, Canadian cards as a kid, back when kids did that. I'm not sure if they do it anymore. Anyway, I opened a package. I remember getting this hologram card. It wasn't a regular hockey card. It was one of those little holograms. If you tilt it in the light, it shows different images. And I was kind of like, I was kind of pissed. I'm like, oh, this is not even a standard hockey card with the player and the stats on it. And I thought, oh, this is garbage. I don't want this. Like, I'm kind of pissed that this was in my package. Anywho, you used to go to the store and buy those hockey magazines that would tell you the price of that card, I guess, on a quarterly basis or whatever it was. And I looked and it was like $375 for this card. I guess collectors needed it to complete the set. And there was, I know, few and far between of them, whatever. And I had one. And I thought, holy smokes. So I bought the next quarter of the magazine and it dipped in value to like, I don't know, $325. So I went to my dad to a local hockey trade card exhibition and sold the card to an older guy that was interested in completing his set, and I made $300 on it. So that for me was a lot of money, obviously, back then. This was probably in the 80s. And took that to my bank when you used to have to get the books printed out, you know, and fill out the deposit forms and wait in line. And seeing that money in the bank account just kind of, wow, it was wow to me at the time. So that's probably the craziest thing to earn money. It's not that crazy in the end.
Awesome. What age did you become a millionaire?
Good question. I don't know exactly because, again, I wasn't paying attention to any of this. I wasn't tracking net worth. I wasn't, to be honest, I used to get, when I invested in index funds, I think it was monthly, they would mail you, because this is pre-internet. Well, was it pre-internet? Yeah, I guess it was, because I remember filling up faxing in forms and stuff. And so you would get the mail to you, they were very confusing. Like, the credit to the online world and online investing apps, it's Wealthsimple in Canada, that's a leader in sort of the app-based investing. You have other ones in the US, but it's so simple to track how well your investments are doing and your net worth nowadays. So we use Wealthica in Canada, but there's, I think, Personal Capital, or it's called something else now in the US, and Empower, I think, now in the US. And that's made it so much easier. So I wasn't tracking anything. I would get those paper statements. I wouldn't even look. I couldn't understand them because they were so confusing the way they were written back then. And so I would simply rip them up, knowing that I was doing the right thing. I was putting money into diversified index funds, domestically and US and internationally. And so I was doing the right thing, and I just didn't care, didn't look, didn't track anything. And then when I became a millionaire, I don't know, because I was buying real estate too and not tracking any of it, just appreciating that if you hold the property for about 10 years, it's going to go up in value. Now in Canada, as I mentioned earlier, we've seen extreme increases in property values that I bought way low that are astronomically. I bought my home for a couple $100,000. It's now probably close to a million. And so I just never tracked it. But once I went down the rabbit hole of FIRE, I would say 3 to 5 years ago, that's when I started tracking. So I would say, if I had to put an age on it, sorry for the long-winded answer to your question, I would say probably in my maybe 35, give or take.
Nice. What's a closely held belief that you had that you recently changed your mind on?
This is the toughest one to answer. I think for your guests, generally, when I listen to your show, they struggle with this one. I would say the transition from, if I have to give you an answer on the spot, I would say investing in, I know all the science and data in the personal finance space tells me that index investing in total returns is far superior to dividend investing. I respect that. I agree. 100% it is. And I encourage people, sometimes my, you know, friends or younger people, you know, maybe tenants, and even I have in my rental property, will ask me about this because, you know, we'll have a conversation and I've done fairly well in my life, I think. And they'll ask me, you know, advice. And I'll say, just use a robo-advisor and just put your money in and they'll allocate it for you in a globally diversified index. And you don't set it and forget it. Don't worry about it. And increase the amount of income and reduce the expenses on the three main things, like your housing, vehicle, and food, as much as you can. And then you set yourself up well. And so I've changed from that sort of index to dividend investing. And I recognize that it is not the most efficient and superior mode. However, I know in an early retirement scenario, sort of the work optional early retirement phase that I'm entering, being able to live solely off of the dividend income and not have to worry about the sort of cash bucket, yield shield, all those other strategies people have to withdraw their 3 or 4%, not having to spend principal in early retirement and avoid that sort of sequence of return period. I recognize I don't want to be the richest person in the graveyard, so I am going to have to spend that principal, the registered portion of my equities in the RRSP in Canada. At 71, there's mandatory withdrawals. So I'm going to eventually have to spend this. But living off dividends is just, I find, psychologically and mentally comforting. So I've sort of, to answer your question, I've switched from exclusive index to hybrid dividend investor and index investor. And I'm very happy there, although I recognize that may not be the most superior form of investing, but I'm okay with that.
Awesome. Any last pieces of advice?
Last piece of advice, I guess, to particularly the younger investors is just get started, I think. And there's really no excuse anymore. And people will say, well, I don't have a lot of money. And, you know, neither did I. My first job as a lawyer was $40,000 a year. Not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, now, like, you know, back in the day, it took a lot more money to get started. Now you have access to, you don't have to fill out a paper form. You don't have to mail it in. You don't have to fax stuff in. You can download an app in 2 seconds and get set up on one of these online app-based robo-investors and invest as much as a dollar to get started. There's frankly no excuse. So I would say start early and then avoid, as other guests I'm sure have said, avoid the escalation of costs as you increase your income. So, you know, the keeping up with the Joneses, I don't give a hoot what the Joneses are doing. I don't care. And frankly, I never cared really. And keep your three sources of your biggest expenses as low as you can be. So housing, buy less house than you can afford. Don't follow what real estate agents will say, buy the most home you can afford, buy the least amount of home you can afford, keep that cost low. Avoid a car if you can. And, you know, your food is the next biggest cost. So do what you can to eat healthy, but keep those costs low. So that's my advice, is just get started. It takes a dollar nowadays. It's so simple. There's really no excuse anymore.
Awesome. That's Dividend Daddy with a net worth of $2+ million. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Millionaires Unveiled podcast with Jace Mattinson. For more stories, investment opportunities, and information, check out our website, millionairesunveiled.com. See you next time when you'll hear from another everyday millionaire.